Hello, and thanks for joining us at Seen and Unseen Aloud. My name is Natalie Garrett. This is where you get to listen to a curated collection of the editor's top picks from our recent articles. We're here for you when you need to be eyes-free or hands-free, but still want to hear Christian perspectives on just about everything. Fun is Dead by Simon Walters. Imagine there's been a sudden change in plans. The evening meeting is cancelled at the last minute, or your friend is sick and can't come round. There are no looming tasks that need doing, so you set out to have some fun. What do you do? Karen Heller's recent article in the Washington Post suggests that we don't really know how to answer that question. Fun is dead, proclaims the headline, and her analysis is stimulatingly insightful and depressing. Weddings have become stressful extravaganzas, holidays require a constant stream of activity, retirements should have a purpose and a plan. Our fun, our play, requires a reason to exist. Can we have fun without it having some larger purpose? Can we play without needing to post it on social media? Everyone else, it seems, is having much more fun than we are. Take video games. You might think this ought to be the very definition of a playful activity, one with no particular end or purpose in mind. But even here, it seems we don't know how to have fun without some type of incentive. Conversations about video games online are frequently so self-serious and toxic that you'd be forgiven for thinking that it was a matter of life and death, not differing preferences about fun. Some of the world's biggest games, things like Fortnite, Genshin Impact, and EA Sports FC, give rewards to players who turn up to play every day. It sounds generous, till the psychological hooks of these methods grip you far past the point of fun. Players talk about not being able to sustain more than one of these types of games because otherwise they won't have time to keep up. What starts as play quickly turns into a form of work. I am as much a sucker for this method as the next person. I find myself drawn to games which start out as free and fun, but the fun inevitably seems to turn into a chore that I cannot dislodge. There is an unwritten pressure to turn up to play every day, to complete daily tasks, and keep up with the competition. I end up feeling guilty for wasting my time playing games, anxious to keep up with what's required when I do. No wonder, with all these contradictory pressures on play, I find myself more often than not vegetating in front of Netflix rather than really playing. This is all a bit of a first world problem and might seem like another depressing indictment of modern society, but perhaps it shouldn't be that surprising. As humans, we are always looking for some way to justify ourselves, some way of proving that what we do matters. Play, by contrast, demands that we step into a different sort of world. The world of play is a world of grace, where we are free to find pleasure in activity on its own merits and not for anything we might get from it in the end. Play, in its best sense, is purposeless apart from the joy of playing. When we try to give our playful activities some wider purpose for why they matter, we are turning them into something else. The world of the Christian faith is not often seen as a playful one. It seems so very serious, dealing, as it does, with matters of life and death. But within the serious world of the church, a space for play emerges. After all, it is first and foremost a world of forgiveness from what we have done wrong in the past, present, and future. This forgiveness takes away the fear of failure. Whether I am greatly successful or not, I am loved and forgiven by God. This is God's gift, which cannot be earned and cannot be lost. The result, perhaps surprisingly, is that I am free to play, because I do not need my play to achieve anything for me. As the theologian Simeon Zahle puts it, in play, A person is free to engage with the world creatively, actively, energetically, but without fear of serious consequences. The Christian is free to play with things that once seemed deadly serious, to find delight in what were formerly objects of fear, and to take themselves much less seriously. In the world of video games, this idea is perhaps most clearly seen in the games produced by the Japanese game developer Nintendo. Their games, from Mario to Zelda, epitomise a vision for gaming which is driven by creating joy for whoever is playing and not unnecessarily burdensome tasks. One of their best games of last year, The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, doesn't offer a prescriptive path for how players should approach its challenges. Instead, the player is given a toolkit and set loose to use it in the world as they see fit. The result is a sense of joyful freedom, a feeling that its world is full of delight and even silliness. It gave me some of the most fun I've had playing games in recent years, without me even coming close to finishing it. It's this playful attitude that I want to take into the rest of my life. What would it look like for us to see the world as a playground rather than an exam hall? The result wouldn't just be a lot more fun. I think it would also be deeply Christian. Sarah Everard, She Was Exactly Like Us, by Belle Tindall. This week, 3 years ago, we'd been shut in our homes for nearly a year and things were anything but normal. I don't know about you, but when I think back to those lockdown days, it's all a bit of a haze. Those weird weeks tend to blur into one. Except this week, that is. This week, 3 years ago, was a wholly different story. We, the public, had just learned that Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman in South London, had been abducted, raped, and murdered by Wayne Cousins, a serving police officer in the Metropolitan Police. And the news of this heinous crime took our breath away. Do you remember it? How you felt when you learned what had happened to Sarah? I can remember the anguish of hundreds of people ringing out from Clapham Common, reaching every corner of the country. I can remember that, legal or not, something seemed to quell the outrage that was drawing people to the vigil being held there. All that grief had to go somewhere. The anger that night was so visceral, it feels like it's still in the soil of the common. The fear so palpable, it still lingers in the air. And at that point, we didn't even know the half of it. She was just walking home. That's the sentence, isn't it? The one that haunted those days, weeks and months. 3 years on, and we're no closer to coming to terms with what happened. Not really. In the wake of the recent Angelini inquiry, which concluded that Wayne Cousins should never have been allowed to become, let alone remain, a police officer, the BBC released a documentary that follows DCI Catherine Goodwin's story as she led the investigation. From first seeing the bulletin of a missing young woman to hearing the whole life sentence come down on Cousins, viewers are walked through the whole thing, step by step. What led up to Sarah's death and what followed it. Something that we should all see, even though we'll immediately wish that we hadn't. Because it would be hard to unsee the grainy footage of Wayne Cousins standing next to a handcuffed Sarah on the side of a busy road, abducting her while his hazard lights flash, all of it so sickeningly hidden in plain sight. It would be harder still to unhear the victim statement from Sarah's mum, who admitted that every night, right at the time of the abduction, she silently screams, "Don't get in the car, Sarah, don't believe him, run!" All of it is just so hard to know. The details are hard to think about, and harder still not to think about. But that's the point, I suppose. I remember what philosopher Simone Weil wrote, that capacity to give one's attention to a sufferer is a very rare and difficult thing. It's almost a miracle. It is a miracle. I'm just not used to a miracle making me feel so nauseous. In theory, Vile's words are beautiful. In reality, though, they ache. I don't tend to acquaint the feeling of utter helplessness with the miraculous, where my understanding runs dry, my answers falter, and my tears flow. Those aren't the places I expect to see anything of any use, spiritual or otherwise. But Vile goes on. It is recognition that the sufferer exists, not only as a unit in a collection or a specific from the social category labelled unfortunate, but as a man or woman exactly like us, who was one day stamped with a special mark by affliction. Sarah Everard, her memory, as well as the people within whom her memory is most vivid and her loss most keenly felt, deserve the miracle of our attention. Then, now, and for many years to come, we continue to grieve her, the woman who never made it home. As if we each knew more of her than her name. And that's a beautiful thing, a human thing, a sacred thing. Because Sarah was more than her name, and she was more than her death. And so she must be grieved as such, with our eyes fixed on the beauty of who she was, and the tragedy of who she will never be. And then there's Vile's exactly like us line to grapple with, and grapple with it we do. The knowledge that it could have been any of us is ever present. As a woman, I feel it every single day. If male violence against women is a spectrum, one being a wolf whistle as we walk down the street and 10 being death, the truth is that most of us will only ever face experiences that sit on the lower end of that scale. And yet we are ever aware that 10 exists and that we could encounter it at any point. So we're on the lookout for it. We are alert, always. Sarah walked home a specific way that night, not the quickest route, but the best lit. That's what we all do. Exactly like us, indeed. Lament. I suppose that's what this feeling in my stomach is, and maybe yours too. It's a feeling that goes beyond the rage I feel towards the monstrous perpetrator and the institutions that fail to stop him and so many others. It's a kind of wordless grief that things are the way they are. Agony that we live in a world that hurts this much. Despair at how things could have been so different. I felt all this 3 years ago, when I heard about Sarah's death. And I felt it last night, when my sister walked home from my house in the dark with her hood up so that she was less distinguishable as a woman walking alone. And it's tricky, because you can't tidy up lament, can you? There's no silver lining, nothing to polish. You can't put a neat bow on despair or grief, and you can't pull yourself out of it by your bootstraps. And that's not to be defeatist, or to relinquish our responsibility to enact justice and fight for change. On the contrary, lament is rooted in the knowledge that things can be and should be better. But to try and find a way to solve the outrage we feel when it comes to the death of Sarah Everard is to completely misunderstand it, and ourselves, and reality. Bad things hurt. So, although writing this piece has been hard, I'm at least comforted in the knowledge that it was supposed to be a hard piece to write. And that the queasiness I feel and the tears that are threatening my professional resolve are the evidence of some kind of miracle that I don't fully understand. Ted Giola is right. We're all addicts now. By Jonathan Rowlands. There's a joke told by David Foster Wallace in a speech called This Is Water. Two young fish are swimming and come across an older fish swimming the other way. The older fish says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" The two fish swim on until one of them turns and asks, "What the hell's water?" Unlike fish, however, for humans, time is the water in which we swim. There can be no understanding or meaning in life without time. taking the ending of the old BBC sitcom Blackadder Goes Forth. It's set in World War I, as a group of soldiers try to escape the near-certain death of going over the top. In the last episode, they are stood at the foot of their trench, waiting to attack the enemy. Suddenly, the artillery stops. One soldier takes this as good news. "It's over," he shouts. "The Great War, 1914 to 1917. This joke only makes sense with time. I can only find this funny from the perspective of someone in a different time from those in the narrative. This only makes sense to someone who knows the war instead finished in 1918. Time makes the joke. Robert Jensen, the late American theologian, was wrong about a lot, but he was often wrong in the right way. Jensen wasn't afraid to follow through on the implication of some of Christianity's most fundamental claims, even if it led him down paths others would be wary of treading. If Jensen ends up entering the pantheon of the church's great teachers, it will be for his flaws as much as his successes. One of the most helpful aspects of Jensen's theology is on time. We often think of time as some sort of process, a way of moving through life and getting from A to B. However, Jensen stressed that time is a creature, a thing given existence by God, not just some neutral aspect of the universe to be taken for granted. God is without time, and may have created us to be creatures without time too, but God did create time and created us to live within time. This suggests we might learn something about human nature by reflecting on what it means to be creatures that inhabit time. But time is so ubiquitous that we can't think about time except as creatures within time. It is, in other words, like trying to bite your own teeth. Okay, great. Time is important. Big deal. Why should you care? Isn't this just the sort of nonsense philosophers come up with to look busy? Well, this matters because our ability to think with and in time is under serious threat, and with it, our ability to flourish as creatures. For the last 2 years, the famed music critic Ted Giola has offered his thoughts on the state of culture. This year's is a rather bleak read. Giola argues that we've misunderstood the relationship between art and entertainment. We often think of art as something done for the artist, while entertainment is something done for the audience. Creatives must choose whom they create for, themselves or their audience. Instead, Giola suggests it's better to think of a food chain. Entertainment is parasitic upon art and uses the artistic to fuel its inexorable growth. Recall Martin Scorsese's infamous comments about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They're not cinema, they're roller coaster rides. They're not art, they're entertainment. But there's always a bigger fish. We are, Giola argues, entering a post-entertainment culture. We're no longer seeking entertainment. We're seeking distraction. Films become TV, shows become TikToks, books become blog posts, become tweets. The way in which we engage in reflection upon the world around us are increasingly reduced to shorter and shorter sound bites at the expense of substantive, thoughtful analysis. Distraction involves short, repetitive interaction with stimuli to produce dopamine hits. Because this leads to pleasure, we repeat the process until we become habituated to it. We become addicted to it. Crucially, this addiction to distraction itself is the very thing being sold. We don't become addicted to the content of what we watch. We become addicted to the form of it. The medium is the message, Marshall McLuhan famously said, and so it is here too. We are becoming habituated to addiction itself. Distraction is merely the way in. We are, as Giola shows, all addicts now. There are, of course, numerous worrying issues this raises. Giola himself does a fantastic job at covering some of them. However, in addition to all the psychological harm this addiction does, our addiction to distraction is curtailing our ability to inhabit our nature as creatures in time. As we saw earlier, time brings perspective, and perspective brings understanding. We depend on time itself to help us make sense of events in the world and in our lives. The creature that is time is, in this respect, a gift from God and a reminder of our own limitations as co-creatures with it. But the more we become addicted to short-term distraction, the less able we are to inhabit understandings of the world that emerge as a result of long-term reflection and deep thought. We are becoming creatures in time who are gradually losing sight of our dependency on time itself to understand what is most of service to the common good. Look, social media and everything that accompanies it can be great. The ability to respond to news in real time has its benefits. Public narratives have become increasingly democratized, and that is only a good thing. But the short-term, instant response culture that social media habituates us to cannot come at the expense of the long-term work of genuinely deep thought. If we are to move away from the near universal sense that everything is on the verge of collapsing into chaos, perhaps the first step we might take is to begin again to work with, not against, time. If the short-termism underwritten by addiction to distraction is one of the myriad factors that contributes to our pervasive sense of unease, perhaps we might commit to thinking more slowly. Robert Jensen was right. Time is a creature. We forget this at our peril. Some things can only be healed with patience and the slow passage of time. Until we retrieve an understanding of time as gift, not burden, our capacity to grapple meaningfully with the real substantive issues we face will remain beyond our reach. Thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, help others to discover it. Leave a review and rate us wherever you get seen and unseen alike. Help others discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than they might ever have imagined.